Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the 35th edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Coming up on this episode, we'll talk about upstart high-end clothing retailer Vineyard Vines. We'll also discuss goings-on in the office supply retail industry. But we lead our show off today with Finish Line, as they report their second quarter earnings last Friday before their opening bell. We mentioned this on last week's podcast that both of us were looking forward to these set of earnings, and they actually met and exceeded market expectations. However, the stock did fall over 5% in trading rest of the day on Friday. It since picked back up slightly. Overall, second quarter sales for Finish Line were $509.4 million, which is a 5.4% rise year over year, and they also saw positive same-store sales analytics.
I'm actually a little bit depressed because this is our only earnings call for this Retail Focus podcast, so a little bit depressed on that side. But overall, as for Finish Line, they did have a pretty good report. Finish Line reported comparable store sales, or same-store sales as we refer to them as, at 5.1%. Diluted income per share was 53 cents, pretty much in line with expectations overall. They did beat on revenue, as you mentioned, $509.4 million. This is a 5.4 rise year over year, but this beat analyst expectations, consensus expectations that were around $594 million. So a 3% beat on revenue. However, just meeting expectations on the profit side of things, expectations were 53 cents per share, and again, they had 53 cents per share. However, if you compare that, as we did with revenue, to the last year, earnings per share were 57 cents, so this actually represented a 7% drop in profit. However, again, this did meet analyst expectations, so there were some charges in there that were expected, but overall, they were performing at a very high level. Full-year same-store sales are expected to come in the range that they were for the previous two quarters for this year, between 3 and 5%, and full-year revenue is expected to increase by about the same amount at 3.5%. So if you compare this to its larger, biggest competitor, Foot Locker, they're really gnawing at the market share there and really taking some of that mall traffic that Foot Locker has been so successful in having over the previous few years.
And it's not only the brick and mortar mall traffic and potentially the mall traffic through their branded stores inside Macy's locations, but it's also e-commerce traffic as well. Finish Line is one of the companies that actually includes e-commerce sales in their same store sales metrics, which is somewhat unique. A lot of businesses choose not to do that, but given that same store sales are up across the board, that kind of tells you that e-commerce sales are following the same direction. A lot of good things here from Finish Line. Historically, they've been a business that hasn't had a lot of interest-bearing debt. In fact, since 2014, this has been a long-standing trend where they haven't had any interest-bearing debt since at least that point. And you look right now, they've got $114.3 million in cash. That's an increase by several million over the $79.5 million they had in February in cash. Now, if you go back to February of 2015, they had nearly $150 million in cash available to them. However, keep in mind that we're comparing this year's quarter two against last year's quarter two, when the decline hadn't yet happened for Finish Line. It was their terrible quarters three and four that caused the mix-up at Finish Line. Sam Sato to come in as the CEO, where we've seen a turnaround over the first two quarters so far of this fiscal year. And really, since Sam Sato took over at Finish Line, the business has been trending upward after that quarter three that saw a massive drop in same-store sales of about 6%. And last year, the same-store sales, even for the second quarter, only increased 1.5%. So you're still seeing increases that are greater this year over last year. They're finding ways to streamline their supply chain, which we had talked about earlier this year, was a main reason for Finish Line's initial decline in same-store sales. And Sato also mentioned that they had inventory reduction actions over the course of this last quarter. Despite that, their inventory actually grew. Their inventory increased 1.5%. 6.6% from the prior year's quarter, from $366.3 million worth of inventory to $372.3 million worth of inventory. And many businesses, you'd be worried about their inventory control, worried that they're keeping more product on hand. But in the case of Finish Line, this is actually a positive thing, because one of the knocks on them coming into the Sato regime was basically that they had trouble stocking the most popular sneakers and making sure that they had a variety of sizes stocked, not only in the e-commerce realm, but also at their brick and mortar stores. They've been doing a better job of that, and he continues to streamline inventory and inventory practices, which has appeared to result in positive returns for the footwear retailer.
Yeah, throughout the call, you really get the sense that they are going to be focused on the customer more and more, and they're not going to have any supply chain glitches either. And so I think by having a high inventory, you're ensuring that customers with unique shoe sizes and unique wants overall within the sports industry get what they come in for. So I think this is a really good focus, and I think they have a lot of opportunities going forward, particularly in the omnichannel arena. If you look at this company, they don't really pride themselves on having a good e-commerce platform. But I think this is something they're going to focus on in quarters 3 and 4. And I think analysts were really pointing to this, saying that they're potentially sandbagging for the full year guidance because of this. They have a lot of growth opportunities here, and I wouldn't be surprised if you see same store sales increase beyond what they're predicting as a company between that 3 and 5% measure. But overall, I think this company is operating better than they had been, especially if we compare this to last year. And it's an interesting note, if you just see on their website at Finish Line's investor relations page, they say that we employ more than 14,000 sneakerologists who help customers every day connect with their sport, their life, and their style. So again, it's just reiterating the fact that they are focused on their customers' wants and desires when they come into those stores, and that customer service is number one, and that's how they're going to really have the competitive advantage when you're looking at their brick and mortar formats. But again, it's going to have to be a combination of both if they're to succeed in this current very competitive environment that they are in, especially when you're seeing overall mall traffic numbers decrease. We like to think back to when we had our last earnings call with Foot Locker, and their CEO proclaimed that malls are not dead. This really relates to Finish Line's business as well, as even though you're seeing a diminishing amount of people coming into malls, the overall amount of sales for those mini anchors, if you will, can still remain stable.
Going back to the sneakerologist line, I think that also kind of signals a change in the overall direction of the company. I was speaking to someone who was formerly an assistant manager at a single Finish Line location, and she was telling me that basically they saw a change in the course of the last 2 years away from a store that was really focused on the runner, really focused on the athlete, to being a company that is focused on fashion. And I think that term sneakerologist certainly suggests that. Finish Line is in a unique spot because, and this is something that you mentioned before we came on to record, oftentimes they can be competitive on price with the larger e-commerce retailers like Amazon, for example. Even in the brick and mortar realm, where you think of them having potentially higher overhead than e-commerce retailers like that, they are very competitive on price with not only Amazon, but larger retailers like Dick's Sporting Goods. So looking forward for Finish Line, what you'd like to see, obviously, is increased and drastically increased same-store sales over the third quarter last year, that same third quarter where they saw a 6% decline 1 year ago. But also coming up, there are several significant sneaker releases, not only by Nike, but also by Under Armour. And I know this is something that the company and the folks at Finish Line also have their eyes on. They want to be sure and execute properly on these sneaker releases so as to maximize their store revenue, not only with top line revenue, but as Sam Sato said, they've been very good at managing expenses. And so you've seen margins also climb for Finish Line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's an interesting dynamic when you have the companies that supply your product also selling directly to the consumer. So you're saying Under Armour and Nike expanding their e-commerce platform, selling directly to the consumer to really capitalize on those increased margins from their products. And with that, as you mentioned, you're seeing marketing of new products, marketing that really Finish Line and Foot Locker can't keep up with, because Nike and Under Armour know their own products better than they do. So it's it's an interesting dynamic when you have that inner competition. And I think it's going to be a fair balance between what Nike wants to do as far as selling directly to the consumer and trying to keep the businesses they sell to happy in the meantime. But as for the stock, Finish Line has actually performed quite well for the year, but they're actually down 5% or so from this earnings call that was last Friday. So the stock dropped about 5.2%, and the stock is hanging right around that same point now, trading at around $22.75 per share as of this recording of the podcast. The pre-earnings trading was around $24 a share. So again, down around 5%. The stock is up again for the 52-week trailing period by about 16%. So overall, a lot of good optimism with this stock as they have a high PE multiple. The market cap for Finish Line is $894 million. But again, I hate to compare so often to Foot Locker. Again, their bigger competitor here, but Foot Locker has a $9 billion market cap to put in perspective. And then also, if you look at overall locations, Foot Locker has over 3,000 locations, about 1,100 of which are in the United States. And then Finish Line has 660 about in the United States, not including those Macy's locations, and about 320 abroad. So a lot of ground to make up if you're Finish Line. But if you just look at the stock price, you can see that a lot of optimism is built in. And anytime you're seeing positive comps, especially with a mall staple like Finish Line, this is really good news for the shareholder. Moving on for our second story of the podcast, we're going to be talking about shopping carts. This is a topic that you and I, Trent, don't talk a lot about, but shopping carts came up in the news because Target halted a nearly one-year pilot program of kitty carts, small carts designed for children of guests that come into the store. They had these carts in about 72 stores, but what was interesting is they had piloted in about 10 stores for a little more than a year before problems popped up. So it was quite interesting. They expanded in their locations that they were currently in Minnesota and in New York. Again, 72 total locations. And late last week, Target announced via a press release that they had actually taken all of these carts out of the stores due to a number of issues. They were having reports of children throwing the carts down, therefore spilling the merchandise that was in the carts, and then also kids running with the carts down the aisles in an unsafe fashion, hitting some customers. Therefore, some guests of Target stores were complaining to management that they had bruised shins and ankles. So not a good look for Target, but again, an interesting thing in that they had these carts out at 10 locations for about a year, had positive reports from these stores, and then expanded the program only to abruptly shut it down.
And the funny thing is about this, the minute they took the carts away, then they also saw a backlash from the public on social media. One was quoted as saying, "My daughter loved your little carts. Why are they gone?" So this really goes to show that no matter what you do as a large retailer, you're never going to please everyone on social media. It's kind of an old adage that we have in broadcasting where you know that you're not going to please 100% of your listeners. You might aim for it, but you're never going to please 100% of people out there. As you mentioned, piloted originally in 10 stores, expanded to 72 stores, and then almost immediately yanked back. A lot of customers were using social media complaining about getting their ankles and shins banged up. And in addition to, of course, the children running the carts up and down the aisles, some parents were concerned that it made it difficult for them to control their kids. Now, this isn't a first-time program that Target is offering. It's a first-time program for them. But many grocery stores, especially smaller grocery stores, offer miniature carts for children. And it hasn't been as big of a problem for those smaller retailers. The problem is, though, Target, of course, is more well-known. They're more widely used. And they have a larger social media presence. And that's really where we saw the backlash here with Target. Christy Welker, who is a Target spokesperson, was quoted as saying, "At Target, our guests are at the center of everything we do, and we value their feedback. We briefly tested kitty carts at 72 Target stores, and after reviewing guest and stores' feedback, we've made the decision to stop the test." Above and beyond the feedback they got on social media, above and beyond the feedback they got from customers, I think the bigger issue might be from employees. When you look at these carts, these are relatively small, and these are tough to keep track of. They don't really fit in the cart corrals that Target has in their lots, and so it makes it more difficult for their cart wranglers or their stock people, the people that are chasing down the carts in the parking lot, to be able to bring those in. Anytime you have different sized carts, you have more trips that you have to make for that person that's bringing the carts in from the parking lot. And you look at some businesses, Walmart Neighborhood Market, Kroger, they both have differently sized carts across the line. And when you look at Target, they also have different sized carts throughout. And in fact, the shopping cart is something that they focus really hard on. In fact, they've released ergonomically designed carts at nearly all locations with slots for fingers and also continuous handles, so the plastic is over the metal over the entirety of the cart handle. Additionally, earlier this year, in fact, March 19th of this year, they underwent an initiative to make Caroline's cart available in all stores. And for those that are unaware, Caroline's cart is designed specifically for parents or caregivers, those with special needs. So a larger seat in the front of the cart, or the cart nearest the person pushing the cart. So Target has paid a lot of attention to shopping carts over the years. And when you're looking at different sized carts, perhaps, and convenience carts and Caroline's cart, you're looking at needs, not necessarily desires or wants. And Target looked at this program in its 72 stores and wondered what it was actually getting out of the program. It made things a little bit of a hassle for the people whose job it was to wrangle the carts in the lot. It made it a hassle for their customer service personnel to have to clean up the messes that were made by the children piloting these carts. And then they had to look and wonder why. Why were they doing that? Were they trying to indoctrinate the 4 to 6 year olds into the Target shopping culture? Now, sure, maybe those kids had a fun experience while they were pushing around the Target cart, and maybe they had fun while doing so, and maybe Target was able to push home some brand engagement. But when you look at it all, is it really worth it? How much brand engagement are you really trying to push home to 4 to 6 year olds when in reality you're alienating a lot of your other customers, and you're using man hours to not only chase the carts down, but pick up the messes made by the kids that were piloting these carts in some cases?
You have a lot of really interesting points here with this, and I think you really hit it home when you said brand engagement. This is obviously what they were trying to do. I don't think you can really bolster sales by adding an additional kiddie cart to the normal guest that comes in with their son or daughter. But overall, if you just look at the size of the carts, they're rather small. They're really small, in fact. You could assume that they're made for 4 to 6, 7 year olds, and therefore that's kind of an age where kids are going to be a little reckless. I think if the cart were a little bigger, perhaps you would get maybe some older ages in there, kids who would be a little bit more responsible with the carts. But this is an interesting topic overall, us talking about carts. You really don't think about it until you have these problems while working in a store. One of my first jobs was pushing carts for a large retailer. And oddly enough, anytime they came in with some sort of a hybrid cart for a parent, we had quite a bit of issues corralling those carts, especially when it was going to get busier. So on the weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the carts would all get jumbled together and it was going to be quite a mess. And then people, the customers for the store, had to come in and kind of go through the carts to pick out the one they wanted. So it is kind of a bit of a hassle, something you don't ordinarily think about as a customer. You don't think about the logistics of corralling carts, but it is a thing that really detracts from the business. And overall, again, something you alluded to, you don't want bad PR. Target has been in the news for a slew of topics here recently in the past 6 to 8 months, and this is something they really don't want to add to that. And I did want to mention on one quick thing, when they extended the program out to 72 stores in total, that was actually in August. So again, not that long, about 4 weeks, they had about 62 additional locations for these kiddie carts.
And it isn't only about brand engagement. I should mention that when you introduce the kiddie carts, you also give the parents with small children an opportunity to keep them entertained in the store. And it actually, in some cases, makes things easier for the parent because the child is then pushing the cart and is otherwise preoccupied. And this is something that actually Whole Foods has discovered, because they have used these mini carts in the past. Again, not only to engage the kids that are there, but also to help entertain or distract them while they're grandparents are shopping. So there are different dynamics here. Unfortunately, there hasn't been any significant research that ties into the idea of offering these carts to families at your store and then getting either greater consumer engagement through these carts or driving up top line revenue. So in this case, Target just didn't see the connection there and decided to scrap them. But I'm anxious to see if other retailers will test this out in the future. I mentioned Whole Foods. This is something that they've done for a few years now. And I'm anxious to see if larger grocery chains especially begin to adopt these little carts, despite the fact that some customers might complain about them. Well, we turn our attention to high-end fashion as the clothing chain Vineyard Vines has opened its 63rd store now in a Minneapolis suburb. This in addition to about 10 total stores that have opened within the last month, including two outlet stores. They have 9 total leases that are ticketed to open within the next couple of months, including 3 outlet stores there. For those that are unaware, Vineyard Vines sells very much upper-end clothing. They have agreements with retailers like Nordstrom, for example, as well as their own stores, their own outlets. And much of the clothing is really Martha's Vineyard themed. In fact, the owners spent a lot of time on Martha's Vineyard as children. And so that's really kind of leaked into the way this clothing chain has established their brand. But uniquely, Vineyard Vines is not only growing in overall store count, but is also growing in popularity, especially among households with income over $100,000.
Yeah, you know, when I look at Vineyard Vines, they have a very unique take on the clothing that they sell in their individual locations. They do have a unique stance on their stores overall. The typical store for Vineyard Vines is between 4,000 to 6,000 square feet. So this is really perfect for the outlet mall concept. We talk about a lot of stores trying to get into these outlet malls because these are really the new shopping centers, especially these large metropolitan locations. They're more of a shopping hub. This is coming in the wake of less traffic to indoor malls overall. So they're really trying to take advantage of this and the fact that they sell not only to just one demographic. They sell to men, women, and children, and they really encourage the entire family to come in and experience the stores for themselves. The two outlet locations that were open previous to this opening, one was in the Chicago area and one was in the Estero, Florida area. So these outlet malls are quite large. And again, these are just hubs. They're basically destinations for not only tourists, but the people that live near those bigger metropolitan markets. So I think this is a good strategy by them. They're not growing too fast and they really know what they want here. The owners actually came up with this idea, this overall concept in 1998. It's brothers Shep and Ian Murray who founded Vineyard Vines. And according to the company's website, the brothers really decided on this concept because they were tired with the day-to-day life in their business careers in Manhattan. They wanted something lighter, something they feel they could connect with customers better with. And since then, it has really taken off. The biggest growth you've seen with Vineyard Vines has come in the last couple years. And if you go to their website, vineyardvines.com, it's a really well laid out website. It's very simplistic though. It really sends home maybe some of the merchandising concepts that you'll see in those brick and mortar stores.
And we don't get a chance to talk too much about Vineyard Vines because they are still a private company, but they are a company, a fashion company on the rise. You talked about price points. Most of them range from about $25 to $300 in stores. There's some menswear that's actually a little bit higher than $300 in their stores, but they make a comment in most of their new opening releases that they look for trends more than price. So they're trying to fit with trends. And again, many of these trends are, if not beach oriented, then certainly resort or sailing oriented. They have a sponsorship deal with the America's Cup. They have a sponsorship deal with the Kentucky Derby. And that should give you a little bit of an idea of where this clothing is popular. Again, 63 standalone locations with their Edina, Minnesota location. It's a Minneapolis suburb opening up over the course of this last week, and 9 locations ticketed to open, including 2 outlet locations in South Carolina, 1 outlet location in Virginia. There's also 2 locations in California and New Jersey, each ticketed to open within the next few months, 1 in Jacksonville, Florida, and 1 in New Orleans as well. So they've got several outlet stores existing, now 16 outlets with 3 more to open. So they've got the off-price segment as well. And one of the things that's really impressive when you look at Vineyard Vines is their merchandising. You mentioned their square footage, 4,000 to 6,000 square feet. This is a larger square footage for a retailer such as this, and it gives them the opportunity to merchandise their stores in such a way that is a little bit looser. There's a little bit more empty space. Sometimes you'll see maybe the faux hull of a ship located in the stores. They've all got kind of a nautical theme about them, and you see a lot more room to move inside the store. So it kind of connotes the high class feeling that you get around their clothing. The other remarkable thing about Vineyard Vines, we've talked so much over the past several months really about a lot of the mall retailers, your Aeropostales, your Hollisters, your American Eagles, selling less branded products, fewer products with their names on them, with their logos on them. With Vineyard Vines, it's almost the exact opposite. In fact, the grand majority of the clothing they sell has their Smiling Whale logo on it. And their Smiling Whale logo, if you've not seen it, again, you can view it on their website, Vineyard Vines. And it is almost a dead ringer for the Hartford Whalers Pucky logo that was around in the 1970s and 1980s. And these two founders of the company are from Connecticut, so there might be some connection there. But you see this Smiling Whale everywhere. They use it in their cross promotion. They use it in their marketing. They even use it on their blog, where you see the whale imprint in the outline. They've done an excellent job branding that whale, and a lot of people want that whale on their clothing. It is very unique. It is almost like a badge of courage, similar to those brands like Abercrombie and Aeropostale were in the late 90s and early 2000s. But even if you go onto a college campus today, you are very likely to see some Vineyard Vines apparel with that logo, or at least with their word mark on it. And right now, whales are the it mammal. So you see a lot of clothing and a lot of cross-promotional merchandise outside of Vineyard Vines with whales, so they're taking advantage of it. But it's really unique. We haven't seen a company like Vineyard Vines come up in quite some time, where you even see people buying Vineyard Vines bumper stickers and stickers for the back windows of their car. It really is almost a lifestyle when it comes to their brand engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you peruse their website, you can see all the accessories they sell for both men and women. So you're talking about belts, you're talking about flip-flops, boxers, socks, hats, and all of these items, typically 90% of them have the logo on them. So they really want to drive home that brand awareness there. But I think this is a question of, look, fashion retail is always in flux. Are they going to be a fad, or are they going to be a trend? And that's something they're going to have to answer in the next few years as they grow in size. A lot of people like this right now. They like the clothing, they like how it fits, and they like the whale logo. But let's be honest, a lot of fashion is predicated upon change. And over time, people have grown not to like logos on their shirts. We've all heard about the problems with Aeropostale, Abercrombie and Fitch, and because of those problems, a lot of retailers in the fashion industry have really shied away from having signature logos on their apparel. But again, if you look at Vineyard Vines' accessories, they don't shy away from it at all. Again, it's on their socks. They have socks where the whale logo's printed everywhere. It's stamped on the sock all the way up. So it's a bold take overall, and I would be surprised if this was not just a fad. I think they really need to look forward to see other things that they can do, maybe to branch out. But they do have a good selection of things like handbags, something that is actually at a higher price point. I was a little surprised by an average handbag, according to their website, is around the $200 price point. If you go to the outlet malls, as you mentioned, they will be a little bit off price, but overall, these are some higher price points for things. And I think that people, while it is an interesting niche in the market, are probably going to buy maybe a few shirts and then move on. But again, time will tell with a retailer like this, who is just in its infancy.
And again, they do have partnerships with the likes of Bloomingdale's and Nordstrom as well to sell their branded products. And you're looking at high margin merchandise, not to say that it's necessarily of low quality on the input, but when you look at a lot of their t-shirts and long sleeve t-shirts, really the only differentiable facet of them is the whale logo on them. So you are looking at high margin items. Because they're not a publicly traded company, we don't know exactly what their margins look like, but given their fairly rapid expansion over the last 2 years, one can assume that they're seeing value more in opening their own stores rather than selling their products or their branded products in other stores like the likes of Bloomingdale's and Nordstrom.
Again to the Retail Focus podcast, where we're going to talk about office supplies now. Staples just announced that they're going to have a new CEO. Actually, it's not going to be a new CEO. Shira Goodman had a CEO title before, but it was just in the interim. She was the interim CEO since May. So about 5 months now, she's been interim CEO, and the company felt, the board felt like it was time for her to move up, and they gave her the permanent CEO title this last week. This comes at a time when the office retailer is in constant flux. They're looking to create more omni-channel capabilities, and they're looking to really organize their business in such a way that they're helping the customer, especially in the small to mid-sized business segment. They're really focused on delivery for small business goods. And now is the time for the company to have solid leadership. So a lot of times you see that interim title for several months, if not years in some cases. And really you have to think that you need a stable message in play so that the company can move on. We hear about the Staples merger with Office Depot having fallen through from an FTC judge's ruling. And really, when you look at this, you have to see that they need a solid direction to go in. And with Shira Goodman's vast experience in the office supply industry, she's had over 25 years of experience. And so I think this is a good fit for her. And I think overall, the company just needed a little more stability so that they can restructure successfully.
Goodman joined the company in 1992 and has since then served roles in marketing, human resources, and as also the president of North American Operations. As you mentioned, Leighton, she was the interim CEO for about 5 months. She came into the role in May of this year, and you and I both agree that we felt like Staples had a better plan going forward after the failed merger than did Office Depot and Office Max. It looked like they were willing to try new things, and they made a more aggressive push back towards catalog sales, back towards contract sales with major businesses and businesses that they partner with. One of the things that Staples has done under Goodman's watch of late is they have really pushed their business advantage program to the forefront. In fact, now on their homepage, they actually advertise for businesses with over 10 employees that they can sign up for their Business Advantage program, whereas before it was kind of shuffled back a little bit further on their website. And you look at this program, they're really trying to engage different businesses and get them to sign up with this program, trying to see the value in connecting with Staples over this Business Advantage program. And that's something that Office Depot and Office Max, while they have those things, they were seeing growth in things like cleaning supplies and break room supplies. They still haven't plunged fully forward into that area. They would like to in the future, and we'll get to them in a second during this office supply retail segment. But that's something we saw Staples get a little bit of a lead out on. And of course, they were also testing things like furniture showrooms and rentable office space in some of their locations. They're trying to unlock more of their real estate, which again is something that Office Depot came out and said they wanted to do. But it was a full 2 to 3 months after Staples was announcing some of these initiatives. Early on, I think a lot of shareholders have to be reasonably happy with the job that Goodman has done at CEO. And honestly, from my perspective, looking at the hand she's been dealt, especially after the failed merger, you have to think that she's done a pretty good job with a company that was really on the skids by the time she took over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would really like to see her focusing on the business-to-business division of Staples. Again, that mid-market commercial and enterprise-sized customer base that they have, and they've really been growing it out. If you look at their competitors, mainly Amazon, that is the one thing that they really beat Amazon with. They've formed really good relationships with a lot of these small to mid-sized businesses. And over time, they've built a trust that a lot of businesses can't come in and just take, regardless of price point. But they need to be able to ensure that they sustain those interactions through the long term. And I think that's something that she's been keen on over her years with Staples. And so I think going forward, they have a lot to work on. They definitely need to work on their social media aspect of their business. I was just on Staples' Twitter account. It is lacking. It is definitely lacking when you're talking about new product promotion. It's lacking in terms of ability to reach out to what the customer wants on a seasonal basis as well. And so I think there's a lot of improvement here. And if you look at their stock, it's really reflective of a company that's been beaten down. A lot of pessimism built into this stock price. Right now, it's trading around $8.30 a share, but 52 weeks ago, it was at around $12 a share. This is actually before the bad news of the merger not happening came about. So again, just a lot of opportunities for Staples in the coming months and years, and I'm very curious to see if Shira Goodman is up to the task. The company did put out a statement to their shareholders and analysts that they did have a very comprehensive search process that included an evaluation of several other candidates, very high-level candidates, and she won out. So I would imagine, again, 25 years of experience, most of that with this company really played a part in that decision-making process.
What they may lack in social media, they certainly make up for not only in their delivery services, which they have increased in terms of same day and even same hour delivery in some circumstances, and they're also testing a lot of exciting new products that I think for Staples could signal the beginning of kind of a new era for them. Back in August, some of our listeners might have read that they were testing out a new system for their mobile iOS app. And what the app allowed is for customers with kids, they could send a photo of their child's back to school list via the Staples Easy system on their app. And actually, Staples would go through and populate the customer's shopping cart with everything that they'd need. So it kind of cut back on the need to shop for back to school for the parents. I think this is a great system, and it's only a matter of time before a parent should be able to type in a child's school at Staples and then perhaps pick up at the store a ready and waiting order for them based on their child's school list. They've also announced an expanded partnership with WorkBar. In fact, they have installed 3 WorkBar at Staples locations in the greater Boston area, which was initially the area that they tested this program out in. And the idea behind WorkBar is pretty much the mobile office concept where people can go in and purchase reservable room access for a certain amount. So again, examples of Staples trying to unlock their real estate, trying to target those small businesses with 10 or more employees, rather than targeting the huge corporations that are already tied up with certain contracts. So a great job by Staples of trying to find different ways to make things work in this new post-merger fall-through landscape.
That's one of the things we really are trying to mention here, and that innovation is going to be key if they're going to be successful and sustained going forward. You can't just do business as usual if your business is suffering. You really have to find other opportunities and think outside the box. And I think that's what leadership is really trying to do here with all of these new ideas. Partnering with schools and things of that nature, those are good ideas because those are ideas that are really e-commerce proof. Amazon can't come in and form a partnership with a school like a brick and mortar Staples location could. So that's an interesting take on a way to compete for Staples. But again, they're going to have to keep up with this innovation if they are going to have a good, sustainable business for the long term.
Well, moving on to the other major brick and mortar office supply retail company, Office Depot and Office Max have decided to completely sell off their European operation. The idea is that this deal will close by the end of the year. The deal is supposedly struck with Aurelius Group, which is an investment firm that's bought all assets and operations, at least provisionally, from Office Depot for their European operations. And Leighton, this is something that doesn't completely come out of the blue. As they said in their second quarter earnings call back on August 3rd, that they were, and I quote, considering strategic alternatives for their European business. Their European business in the second quarter saw their income dip down to negative $10 million from $2 million in the positive in fiscal year 2015 from that same second quarter. Lower sales, lower gross margin, really plaguing their European business. And now with this, they may be able to concentrate more on their holdings in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. And while you're talking about numbers, it is approximately 200 million euro that they were getting in revenue from these locations, or if you have the currency translation in there, about 225 million US dollars. So a pretty hefty chunk of change, but up to this point, they've been closing several international locations, really trying to focus here domestically on the business they have here. This, as you said, isn't really coming out of the blue. They've been knowing for quite some time where they need to focus, where the bigger opportunities lie, and those opportunities are in the United States. So again, this isn't going to close until about the end of the year. They still have some regulatory approval through the European Commission and a Central Works Council. We should assume that that's going to go through. There won't be a lot of labor changes with this deal, considering it is some mid-level retail businesses that are being transferred over to Aurelius Group. But Aurelius, for their part, has actually been known quite some time in the European sector for mergers and acquisitions. So this is really an opportunity for them to take this business that we can assume was profitable and to maybe grow it there overseas. But Office Depot, I think, really wanted to be done with the European aspect of their business overall, and they're still really focusing on closing a lot of stores here. We talk about the Office Depot Office Max merger. They still have a lot of locations that are in very close proximity to one another, and they still have about 300 stores that they need to close over the next couple of years. The total store count that they're closing is about 700 stores. So again, they've already closed about 400 of those in the prior year and a half. But overall, this will enable them to focus more on the United States operations, take a little bit of capital, and executives were saying that the efficiencies that they're going to create out of this should save them around $250 million annually. So not only do they have reduced operations internationally now, they have also had some distribution centers that they've shut down, and they've said that they've really created some efficiencies within their supply chain here. So overall, again, savings of $250 million. They're looking at being really profitable in the years to come. But again, I think it's more about how they change their business model and less about that day-to-day that we talked about with Staples. They're going to have to innovate in kind of the same way that Staples has been over the past few months. I think this is going to really give them the time and capital to do so. So in essence, really the pressure is on. If you're a shareholder, you're going to be looking at some change in the coming months.
And that's exactly it. It should free up capital. It'll free up resources for them to try out some of the things that they had outlined in their strategic initiatives over the last few quarters. Again, they want to keep testing out their store of the future model, which is a lower square footage model, a square footage of about 15,000 square feet, which is down significantly from their prior store's square footage. And they would like to have this going in about 100 different markets over the span of the next year and a half. So it's something that they're testing out now. But in order to be able to renovate their different stores, to move their different stores, they're going to need some of those capital and some of those resources. And that's something that's difficult to do when you're pouring money into what has been for them, admittedly, a losing proposition so far in their European businesses. They had already exited what they considered to be unprofitable Asian business as well. So this is not unique for Office Depot and Office Max to try and exit markets that they felt like they were insecure in. Again, this deal has already been approved by Office Depot board members, but they'll need to seek approval in Europe by the Euro Commission and by a Central Works Council. And again, Office Depot and Office Max, they are in the process of continuing to close stores. They'd like to close even more stores over the span of the next year. In fact, they'd like to close 25 more stores from that August 3rd to end of the fiscal year span. Try to keep with creating those efficiencies, eliminating inefficiencies that were caused by the merger. They're still in the process of streamlining things. And in that regard, it really makes you wonder how an Office Depot and Staples merger would have worked, considering that integration of Office Max and Office Depot hasn't quite happened yet.
I think if that merger would have occurred, I think you would be seeing even more store closings overall. But I think forcing them to compete was the right decision overall. We're going to see a lot more innovation. Again, I keep using that word, but that's what you're going to see on really both sides for Office Depot and Staples. As for the stock price, the investors were pretty thrilled to hear about the sell-off of the European business, even though it hasn't closed yet. The stock initially jumped about 2% on the press release. The stock price has actually fallen since, though, near the lows of earlier through last week's trading. So the stock has been trading for the last 3 months in a range of from about $3.20 per share to $3.70 per share. And right now it's actually trading at the higher end of that three-month range, trading around $3.62 as of the recording of this podcast, but down 50% for the year. And again, this is mostly attributed to the FTC judge's ruling regarding the Staples merger. The judge struck that down earlier this year. There was a lot of optimism built into the company as the company was trading for around $6.50 a share 52 weeks ago. So the stock price has been cut in half because not only that, but because of further store closings and just a really mixed strategy from Office Depot overall. But the company, for its part, still has a $2 billion market cap, a market cap that's actually greater than that of Sears Holdings, even though these are two entirely different businesses overall in the retail sector. They have a 7.2 price to earnings ratio, which would indicate that investors really aren't that bullish on the stock right now. They're a bit on the bearish side of things.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached that point in the podcast where Leighton and I each detail one story that we're looking ahead to for the next week or the next month. And this week, we'll actually begin with my story. I'm looking forward to the earnings call from Pier 1 Imports. Now, we mentioned that there was only really one earnings situation that we were covering in today's podcast. Leighton was a little bit depressed over that, but coming up, we're really into kind of the earnings season in many cases for the third quarter of fiscal year 2016, or in some cases, the second quarter of fiscal year 2016. Not only does Pier 1 report this next week, but Barnes & Noble and Barnes & Noble Education will report. Aeropostale and PacSun, both scheduled to report on September 30th. And then when you get into the beginning of October, there are just a slew of earnings reports that we'll have an opportunity to talk about, including the Container Store and Walgreens, among others. But as far as Pier 1 Imports is concerned, they're a company we haven't talked a lot about on the podcast, but the last time we did talk about them, it was as they were trying to stretch out their omnichannel wings. I'm anxious to see if their increased emphasis and expenditures in the omnichannel realm or in trying to achieve that true omnichannel via cell phone, via device, via desktop, and via their in-store brick-and-mortar experience will pay off for them. Since 2013, the stock has lost about 80% of its value and is currently trading at a little higher than $4 per share. Consensus estimates see revenue falling about 5% year over year, and they're looking at a loss of 5 cents per share for this latest quarter. So I want to see whether Pier 1 Imports is able to beat those expectations and show a little bit more of a positive gain, even if they still show a loss, or if things just get worse for Pier 1 Imports and leave a lot of questions on the table for a specialty retailer who a lot of analysts feel their best times are far behind them.
Yeah, and they do have a lot of competition from the e-commerce likes of Wayfair. A lot of people had dismissed Wayfair initially since their IPO, but they've actually gained some ground and are taking a lot of market share from those staple brick-and-mortar retailers such as Pier 1 Imports.
Not only Wayfair, but also off-price companies like TJ Maxx, Ross, and then, of course, TJX's spinoff Home Goods, those also edging in on Pier 1 Imports market share.
Well, my story comes by the way of News Information, a tech site that actually came out with a report that highlighted companies that are working with certain retailers with some new creative technology. And this is actually going to affect Amazon. Amazon's actually looking to team up with a certain technology that allows temporary access to get in one's home or garage to leave a package. A lot of people are concerned that when they buy a higher priced item on Amazon, it's going to sit at the door for a number of hours until they get home from school or work. So this is a concern that many have had and many have actually expressed with Amazon and have been pretty vocal about when you're talking about Amazon's long-term prospects. People have often said, you can deliver a package within a few hours, sure, but how about the security of that package? Nothing beats the brick and mortar service of getting the items in the store and getting them directly inside your home without having the products just wait outside your doorstep. So they're actually taking a step to get door openers that are then keyed into your home system, which are then triggered when a person delivering your items comes near your doorstep. It'll give them temporary access, just a few minutes to get in and get out of your home and place the package safely and securely where you'll find it when you come home from that long day's work. So this is an interesting thing because not only have they been promising quicker and expedited shipping times, but really now they're going to be answering that one question that so many have been asking for so long. I know me personally, when I buy something on Amazon and I know I won't be home for a day or two, it is in the back of my mind that someone could come by and take that Amazon package. But this will actually give a lot more people peace of mind. But we should say that this is a pilot rollout. They haven't announced anything formally yet. They are just simply looking at the technology and potential markets to have it in.
This technology certainly shows a lot of promise. And as you mentioned, this is a major issue with purchasing online or buying through e-commerce websites. If you work long hours, I know you work a lot of long hours late and you're away from home a lot. I am the same way. Fortunately, I've got neighbors who are retirees, so oftentimes they'll look after my packages when I'm gone. But at the same time, there's a lot of people that aren't in that same circumstance. The question then becomes, how much do you trust your delivery personnel to give them access to your home or at least to step inside maybe an entryway area inside your home?
Yeah, that is the one question that would linger out there is they would really have to build out an infrastructure to where the people would feel really confident with those delivering those packages inside your home. That is the number one factor here is trust.
Well, for Layton, I'm Trent. That'll do it for this week's Retail Focus Podcast. A reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast. Check out our podcast on iTunes or Podbean, where our entire back archive is now stored. And please do check out our website, retailfocuspodcast.com. We'll be back this weekend with a brand new Food Focus Podcast. Until then, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.